Support for this KQED podcast comes from ACT, presenting Let There Be Love, a moving and comic drama about how an aging father and equally headstrong daughter find one another. Opens April 8th at the Geary Theater. ACT-SF.org.
Support for the California Report comes from Bayer, proud to be a Bay Area biotech pioneer for more than 30 years. Bayer, science for a better life. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.
Carrots and sticks. That's what water agencies were hoping to use to encourage conservation and punish water hogs. But a state appeals court took away one of those big sticks this week. So today on the California Report, now what do we do about this drought? Also, a century after the Armenian genocide, the language is facing extinction.
I don't talk Armenian with my friends. None of us do. When they say they do, they're lying.
One teacher's quest to save the Armenian dialect. And what do you do when you can't play a violin? Well, you could play your computer.
Using a laptop, you can do anything that isn't even physically possible. You know, you could have an incredibly wide vibrato on your instrument.
I'm Scott Schaefer, and my vibrato is all warmed up. It's the California Report. All right, so what are you doing to save water? Is it me, or does it seem that this drought thing is finally sinking in on all of us? Water districts around the state are scrambling to figure it out. How in the heck are we going to enforce Governor Jerry Brown's new water restrictions? And joining us now to talk about that and all things drought, KQED Science editor Craig Miller. Hi, Craig.
Hey, Scott.
Well, first of all, Craig, we had this court ruling this week that seems to put, to say the least, a speed bump on the road to more water savings in California. Governor Brown called it a legal straitjacket. So what happened?
Well, it's California. What else? Somebody sued, right? And it went all the way to the Court of Appeal. This was the city of San Juan Capistrano.
The lawsuits are returning.
That's right. Well, they had, you know, they're in the same position as most water agencies around the state of California in how they earn their money. And unfortunately, it's tied to how much water they sell. The more water they sell, the more revenue they get. The more you conserve, the less revenue they get.
So no economic incentive either to encourage conservation or to use less water.
Yeah, when you live in that kind of a world, it's pretty hard for your local water agency to sincerely, you know, promote, you know, to crack the whip to get people to conserve. So many districts are starting to go to this, what they call tiered pricing or conservation pricing, where logically you can use water up to a certain amount, but over that threshold, your rate is going to go up. We're going to actually charge you more per whatever unit of that
water. So an incentive to conserve.
That's right. Unfortunately, the court said, nah, that violates something called Prop 218. Remember that?
No, but you're going to tell me about it.
That's the California law that says basically governments can't make profits, that anything they charge in the way of fees has to be only their costs embodied in that. So if you tell somebody, this is essentially a penalty, we're charging you for excess use of water, that's now, it looks like it's illegal. That takes a huge tool out of the toolbox for conservation around the state that was actually one of the tenets of the governor's, you know, new mandate. So the court has basically now said if you can tie this to your direct costs, then okay, but you can't really call it a penalty and say that's the reason we're charging. Now, Tim Quinn is the head of AQUA, the Association of California Water Agencies, says, well, okay, but that's kind of beside the point. That's kind of beside the entire purpose of this conservation pricing. Here's what he said.
We need people to conserve water every year, not just during drought years. So we don't want a punishment that turns on during a drought emergency and then turns off. We want a pricing structure that encourages conservation each and every year, not just when we can call it a punishment or a fine.
So by one estimate, I've seen maybe a third of water agencies around the state are going to have to kind of go back to the drawing board now.
Yeah, and of course the governor will appeal, but you know, meanwhile, water's running out.
That's right.
So confusion reigns over all of this, and that ruling certainly contributes to it. There's confusion for individual home and business owners and city councils up and down the state as well. So let's start with cities. Some of them are finding themselves now in a bind between the coming state rules and their own local codes, right?
That's right. Take Hanford, for example, down a town down in the San Joaquin Valley. We sent our Central Valley Bureau Chief, Sasha Coca, to check out the situation there where it's actually illegal to do some of the things that the governor and others are urging us to do, like tear out our lawns. Hanford has what's called a living landscape ordinance, which means you have to decorate your yard essentially with living plants, trees, shrubs, grass, and that sort of thing. If you pull those out and put in a rock garden, for example,
you're under arrest.
It's technically illegal. So there are cities up and down the state with similar ordinances now that have been in place for years, like in the 1950s, you know, who are now saying they're scrambling now to see how can we change this so that we can comply with the new state rules.
So last week, Craig, I just want to revisit something. We went to Woodside, California, which is a wealthy town down there in Silicon Valley. They have not been doing their part to save water. And I visited Buck's Restaurant, a very famous restaurant down there. And the owner, Jameis McNiven, told me something that got your attention.
It's been mandated that we don't ask our patrons if they want water. If they ask, we can serve it to them. Isn't the one thing we should do with water drink it? Isn't everything else secondary? I mean, that doesn't save any water. People say it raises consciousness. It just actually makes people unhappy.
Scott, this is what I call a great moment in water conservation confusion.
A teachable moment.
Which is rampant, maybe, let's see, which is rampant up and down the state right now. And this idea that there's some kind of gag order on restaurants didn't sound quite right to me. So we went back to the State Water Board, the entity actually put this rule in place. And fortunately, that is incorrect. There's nothing to stop restaurants from asking you if you want water.
You just can't bring it if they don't ask.
Yeah, the thing they're trying to stop really is four people come in, sit down at a table, and the waiter shows up immediately with four huge tumblers full of water before anybody says anything. That's what's technically against the rules now, statewide. This is a regulation that supposedly went into effect back on March 30th. Since then, I've been to a number of restaurants in the Bay Area where they're still bringing those tumblers of water.
And do you say anything?
Sometimes I do. And sometimes the waiter has said something like, you know, you're right. And I've actually spoken to management about this and they don't care.
One by one, you're going to get restaurants to conserve.
We're
going to
make them. We're going to make them care.
All right. KQED science editor Craig Miller. Craig, thanks a lot.
OK.
Well, drought was not a problem for Japanese American farmers in San Jose a century ago, when what we now call Silicon Valley was known mostly for its farms and fruit orchards. And this year marks the 125th anniversary of San Jose's Japantown. It's one of only three historic Japantowns still thriving in the U.S., and the only one rooted in the history of California agriculture. Rachel Miro reports from KQED's Silicon Valley News Desk.
In a time before semiconductor chips and suburban housing, the region in and around San Jose was largely farmland, much of it farmed by Japanese American families. The city's Japantown was the heart of the community, and that's where you'll find the Japanese American Museum of San Jose. Jimmy Yamaichi is one of the curators of the museum's exhibit on Japanese farming. But more than that, he used to work the fields himself, northeast of San Jose.
Born October 27, 1922, in Berryessa. So I'm a local person for 92 years.
Yamaichi vividly remembers what it was like to grow up on his dad's row crop farm during the Great Depression.
Beans, cucumber, and squash, and other bell peppers and tomatoes and other things. But the beans and cucumber, that's what he was noted for.
He was the fourth child out of 10.
We get up early in the morning, 6 o'clock. And we cut lettuce for about 2 hours.
His dad drove them to elementary school in time for the 9 o'clock bell, then picked them up when school was out at 3 to return to the fields. After the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, white farmers were eager for alternative sources of cheap labor to pick crops. Japanese laborers fit the bill. Some saved enough money to buy their own farms, but California law kept changing to keep that possibility out of reach.
The land laws were called alien land laws because they were directed at aliens ineligible for citizenship, which meant only Asian people.
Columbia University professor Gary Okihiro co-wrote a seminal book about the history of Japanese farming in the Santa Clara Valley.
Many of the farmers were farming on land that did not belong to them, in fact, but belonged to some other person, a white landowner.
In 1929, Jimmy Yamaichi's father found a way around California law, a white man willing to own 21 acres for him in exchange for a royalty that today would amount to more than $27,000 a year, staked on nothing more than a handshake. At the start of World War II, roughly 4,000 Japanese lived in the Santa Clara Valley. They were just beginning to bounce back from the Great Depression when most were forced to sell off their farms and homes and move to internment camps.
When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, our west coast became a potential combat zone. Living in that zone were more than 100,000 persons of Japanese ancestry, two-thirds of them American citizens, one-third aliens.
When the war was over, many of them returned home destitute and demoralized. They converted buildings in San Jose's Japantown into makeshift barracks while they figured out what to do next. Many of the American-born young people, like Jimmy Yamaichi, wanted out of farming. But younger children followed their parents onto new fields, raising labor-intensive crops they could produce on small plots of land, like strawberries and flowers. Leon Kimura was one of those children back in the 1950s.
I picked 10 crates of strawberries, trying to earn enough money to buy my first Timex watch.
And where did Kimura go to get the watch?
I came here to Japantown, to Jackson Jewelers. There always was a feeling that this was home for the JA community.
Eventually, as the rise of Silicon Valley made land more expensive, the strawberry industry moved south to Watsonville and Salinas. The flower business moved overseas. And with each passing generation, more and more Japanese Americans in the Santa Clara Valley dispersed across the Bay Area, California, and beyond.
Maybe it's a function of, if you will, becoming too successful in integrating into mainstream America.
San Jose's Japantown is still a cultural center with churches, restaurants, shops, and, of course, the museum. On April 26th, the neighborhood hosts a festival to celebrate its 125th anniversary. You're invited. For the California Report, I'm Rachel Miro in San Jose.
You may have noticed a lot of news stories this week about the Armenian genocide. That's because it started 100 years ago this weekend. As you may know, it caused thousands of Armenians to flee what's now known as Turkey, taking their dialect with them. As it turns out, Los Angeles is home to the largest population of Armenians in the United States, and their communities are thriving, but here's the thing. The dialect they brought with them is now in danger of fading away. We thought that made it a perfect time to launch a new series we're calling Between Homelands. Here's the deal. We've teamed up with students from USC Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. They're bringing us stories of people living in California who have come from far away or who were born in the U.S. but for some reason feel like cultural foreigners. Andy Vasoyan starts us off with this story about a language teacher trying to save something that may have already died 100 years ago.
Harach Sepejan teaches at a private Armenian school in Los Angeles. Its mission is to protect and cultivate Armenian culture. On this day, two students in his ninth grade language class play a folk song on the kanon. Basically, a 3-foot-long trapezoidal sitar. After the demonstration, Sepejan introduces me. Things start fine, but the boys in the back throw a book bag, and Sepejan just goes off. If they're going to sit and joke, he says, there's no place for them in his class. After class, he explains his frustration at the apparent disregard students have for their dialect. He says UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, put Western Armenian on its endangered list. Every day, languages disappear, and Sepejan says, inevitably, that day will come for Western Armenian. Western Armenians started to die on April 24th, 1915. The Ottoman Empire began systematically killing nearly 1.5 million Armenians in their ancestral homeland. Sepejan says the horrors of the genocide actually led to a rebirth of the dialect. Parents and grandparents were desperate to give their children the sense of belonging that Armenian provided. But But that didn't last, and now some descendants of the survivors have assimilated to the point where the only time they speak Armenian is...
class. Because I don't talk Armenian with my friends. None of us do. When they say they do, they're lying.
Erika Sarangulian transferred last year. Although she's now closer to the Armenian community, she's still worried about getting further from the language. Another of Sepejan's students, Michael Kulhaoglu, has been in the school for years. He's already worried about the next generation keeping the language alive.
At most, like two or three people in this class are probably going to teach their kids Armenian.
He's just saying that now, but he's eventually going to talk to his kids in Armenian.
No, because right now you speak to your family in English, so why would you teach it? Like, it's going to be very difficult unless you send him to an Armenian school.
With an uncertain future for even his brightest students, Hrach Sepejan says he refuses to give up. For him, speaking Armenian and fighting for it is not a choice. For the California Report, I'm Andy Vasoyan in Los Angeles. California Reporti Hamar, Antanik Vasoyan nem, Los Angeles Imech.
Now to the language of music. And on that, you'd have to say Bay Area singer-songwriter Karina Deneke is multilingual. Her repertoire? Well, it's ranged from torch songs and jazz standards to punk rock and art pop. And according to the California Report's jazz critic Andrew Gilbert, you can kind of hear it all on Deneke's new album, Under Glass.
Born in the UK to artists in exile from Czechoslovakia, Karina Deneke spent her childhood performing street theater across Europe, North Africa, and India. As a teenager, she settled with her family in Berkeley, falling in with jazz musicians and the punk scene around 924 Gilman. Over the past two decades, she's been the go-to vocalist for a varied collection of composers and bandleaders, performing and recording in a vast range of bands and projects. So it came as a shock to realize that her new album, Under Glass, is Deneke's first solo project devoted entirely to her own music. Not surprisingly, it's impossible to pigeonhole. There's a dizzying quality to Deneke's music, an uncanny, time-shifting feel where songs at first seem familiar, then take a twist with an unexpected texture or arrestingly original image. She's joined on several tracks by horn players known for their work with Tom Waits, an obvious influence. But where he makes do with his Louis Armstrong rasp, Deneke possesses a voice so rich and luxuriant, she sounds like she was born to sing any song that comes her way. One of the album's consistent pleasures is that Deneke knows just how to frame her voice. She accompanies herself on various organs and keyboards, and often uses Aaron Novick's dry, woody bass clarinet as a snaky counterpoint, like on the dreamy ballad Stop the Horses. Deneke can sound like a dangerous vixen from a film noir nightclub, a brassy show-tune belter, or the leader of a Motown-esque girl group. The shifts from track to track can be jarring, but each song creates its own little world. Here's Having a Go, one of the five pieces where she's joined on harmony vocals by singer-songwriter Lily Taylor. Denneke closes the album with a tender Czech lullaby that her mother used to sing. Is she taking us back home? Was it all just a dream? The title Under Glass suggests something fixed in place. But Karina Denneke's musical world never seems to stop changing, and her tales of travel and exotic locales sound better with each spin.
Andrew Gilbert is a Bay Area writer who covers jazz and world music. He reviewed Karina Denneke's Under Glass. Next up, another in our occasional series we call My Spot, stories about people and places in California that have special meaning to them. Today, we meet an artist and mom. She moved here from India 14 years ago. Now she lives in Tracy, right by Stockton, and she takes us to eat an Indian snack food called Pani Puri at her favorite place, a food stand tucked away in a Fremont grocery store.
Hi. I'm fine. How are you?
My name is Deval Thakur, and we are at the Chatpata corner at New India Bazaar, Fremont. About 10 years back, when I lived in Fremont, and I used to do my grocery shopping here, and I was very excited reading the name Pani Puri, because I was like, oh, finally, something nice back from back home.
Spicy with sweet chutney?
One with sweet chutney, one without.
Okay, try without.
Okay. I would be here, I think, every week and eating Pani Puri. Oh, it's very good. It's very crunchy. And it has this spicy, savory, and sweet feeling in it. There goes potatoes, garbanzo beans, sweet chutney made of dates and tamarind. Green chutney made of green chilies and ginger, and water. Water is made out of main green chilies and black salt. They make you feel very special. So I remember a small thing when my daughter had braces and she couldn't open her mouth wide open. So whenever they would see her coming for her orders, she would pick out the small ones and make sure that it was comfortable for her eating it. How much? A lot of memories come back when I come here to this place. It's very much like being at home, like someone really takes care of you and serves you right in your plate. So all you have to do is take the puri and put it in your mouth.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Deval Thakur was interviewed by Pyle Zaveri. You can listen to this piece again and other MySpot stories online at californiareport.org. That is the sound of a homework assignment done by a Stanford graduate student. It's for a class on laptop music. What's that, you ask? Well, the California Report's April Demboski takes us behind the scenes at the Stanford Laptop Orchestra, where students are getting ready for a performance next week.
Madeline Huberth could play Beethoven with the best of them. She studied cello in college and planned on going professional. Just as she was getting serious about modern classical music, she started getting shooting pains when she practiced. The fingers on her left hand were tingling, and a surgery did nothing to help.
I started losing muscle mass in my hand.
By graduation, she could no longer lift her pinky or stretch her index finger back to play B-flat.
It became very apparent at the end of college that I couldn't pursue performance anymore.
Huber threw herself into studying the science of music. She's now a PhD student at Stanford's Center for Computer Research in Music and Acoustics, where she's become adept at a new musical instrument, her laptop.
Using a laptop, you can do anything that isn't even physically possible. You know, you could have an incredibly wide vibrato.
Huber is the TA for the Stanford Laptop Orchestra. This is a class where students write code to create their own instrument on the computer. By the end of the semester, they will score each of those instruments into a full orchestral work. At a recent class meeting, 14 students sat on a row of meditation pillows, fixing code on their laptops and fiddling with speakers made out of IKEA salad bowls.
Okay, everyone.
Then they each took turns playing a solo. Tim O'Brien began by taking a big breath and blowing softly into his laptop. Then he jingled his car keys over the keyboard and tapped his water bottle. He programmed his computer's microphone to translate these human actions into sound. The class loved it, and so did the orchestra director, Professor Go Wong.
That was like nothing short of magical.
He said he loved it for its humanity.
Tim was able to really find this mix where kind of human meets machine. And in that way, it was like this dialogue. But what came out of the computer was a sound that you would not find anywhere except through a computer.
Wong also likes when students get physical with the medium. One student is programming an armband to produce sounds when he stretches or clenches his hand. Other students are programming cables to produce different notes or rhythms when they pull them up, down, left, or right.
You can rapidly prototype physical gestures, interactions, and map them to sound.
Wong says this makes for a better experience for the audience, one that is both pleasing to listen to and also interesting to watch. Wong was a founding member of the first laptop orchestra, launched at Princeton University 10 years ago. Today, there are more than 70, but Wong says they're really just beginning.
10 years is, it may be a long time in kind of computer years to really make it into an art form. I think it's still quite early.
Wong says the biggest challenge laptop musicians face is the same challenge all artists confront. They're just looking for new and different ways to capture that spark of humanity. For the California Report, I'm April Domboski.
And that is the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. This is the part where we tell you who's on our team, and our director is...
Susie Rocho.
And if you were a dessert, what kind of dessert would you be?
Creme brulee. It's just like hard on the top, but pretty much soft in the middle. That's me.
The technical producer...
is me.
Who's me?
Seal Muller.
We also had additional engineering today from Howard...
Gelman, that's the Howard Gelman.
And what are you doing to save water?
I am drinking champagne. I'm bathing in olive oil, and I am cooking with white wine.
Testing one. The online team includes...
David Weir.
And what are you doing to save water?
I'm not doing very much to save water. I'm going to be honest. I don't use very much water to begin with.
Okay, well, I was meaning to talk to you about that.
Don Clyde.
And if you were a tree, what kind of tree would you be?
An elm.
Why?
I don't know. I've never been asked such a question before. It's the first thing that popped in my head.
David Marks.
That's me.
Natalie Emanijan.
That's a lovely name.
Thank you.
What kind of name is that?
It's an Armenian name.
I'm Olivia Allen Price.
And you're part of our online team.
I'm part of the online team.
And you didn't even know it.
I did not know it. It's true, but now I do.
Our interns include...
Michelle Dutro and Pyle Zaveri.
And which one are you?
Michelle Dutro.
The California Report's editorial team includes...
Victoria Mauleon.
And say it with verb.
Victoria Elena Mauleon.
Ingrid Becker.
And could you say it in Swedish?
Ingrid Becker.
Me, I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. This is the California Report.
Support for the California Report comes from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org. The James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. More at irvine.org. And the Wesley Foundation, improving the lives of California's children.